Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin in a moment and look into the recent intelligence failures which had the US intelligence community and Israel's intelligence service telling President Obama that the risk of Mubarak being toppled was less than 20%. Robert Baer, a veteran CIA operations officer in the Middle East, joins us. Then we'll analyze the President and the Republican House's budget proposals with economist James Galbraith, the author of The Predator State. With no budget this year and no agreement likely on the 2012 budget, we will look into the three big lies muddying the waters. One, that we should even be talking about cutting the deficit and not stimulating the economy. Two, that we are only arguing over 12% of the overall budget. And three, that revenues, which are the only way to redress a deficit, are not on the table. And then finally, we'll talk with Alternet's Adele Stan, who covered last week's CPAC conference and has an article at alternet.org, Right-Wing Disunity Clashes at This Year's Conservative Political Action Conference. She will describe some of the highlights, such as the merciless heckling of Donald Rumsfeld, who was presented with, I'm not kidding, the Defender of the Constitution Award by Dick Cheney. I'm speaking with Robert Baer, author of the New York Times bestseller Sleeping with the Devil, about the Saudi royal family and its relationship with the United States, and See No Evil, which recounts Baer's years as a top CIA Middle East operative. See No Evil was the basis of the acclaimed film Syriana, which earned George Clooney an Oscar for his portrayal of Mr. Baer. His most recent book is The Devil We Know, dealing with the new Iranian superpower. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Baer.
Great to be here.
In terms of the apparent intelligence failings, as I mentioned in the opening, my understanding is that both the U.S. intelligence community and Israel's intelligence service were telling President Obama on January the 25th that the risk of Mubarak being toppled was less than 20%. Is that your understanding?
It is. I think the CIA missed it. Mossad missed it. Everybody missed it. The State Department missed it. You know, people weren't paying attention to Egypt. That's just the truth.
And why is that? Because I take it that what they're paying attention to, what the CIA station in Egypt is paying attention to, is stuff, perhaps weapons being shipped through the canal, the Muslim Brotherhood. Is that what's happening, that they're being tasked to look for the bad guys and not look what is happening within the country itself?
Well, Ian, I think it's worse than that. I mean, two-thirds of CIA personnel right now are devoted to Afghanistan and Iraq, to two wars we probably don't need to be in. It's just, it's drained the place. If you have a station in Baghdad of 1,000 people and you have the same thing in Afghanistan spread across that country, you don't have anybody for Egypt. All those people that were supposed to go into Arabic language programs, become specialists, have all been drawn away. No one was looking at the street. And as small as it is in Cairo, what they're devoted to is dealing with the Egyptian government, or they're dealing with, bin Laden or something else. I mean, we have to look at it this way. The intelligence community is looking in the rearview mirror at 9/11, and that's all it's thinking about. So when the street explodes, they don't have a clue.
Well, apparently Stephanie O'Sullivan, who's the CIA Associate Deputy Director, when she was talking, recently appearing before the Intelligence Committee, chaired by Senate Intelligence Select Committee, chaired by Dianne Feinstein, Feinstein said that, I have doubt whether the Intelligence Committee lived up to its obligations in this area, talking about Egypt. The CIA official, Stephanie O'Sullivan, said that some information was, we'd warned of instability. Well, that sounds like vague sort of boilerplate stuff, doesn't it?
Yeah, this stuff happens all the time. You always, if you're an intelligence agency, take a look at instability, and they've actually got algorithms they can run through a country's economy and its politics and, demographics, and they come up with saying, hey, there's a 30% chance that this country could collapse in however many years. But it's like the Iranian nuclear program, where every 4 years, somebody either in Israel or the United States will predict that Iran's going to get a nuclear bomb. It's just the way these things work. But actually, explaining to the president that the Egyptians are hungry and the unemployment is so high that it was coming to a point, no one predicted that. And you would think the Israelis of all people would have, but they didn't either. I mean, they are so focused on the West Bank and Gaza that they missed Egypt.
So Robert Baer, again, former top CIA Middle East operative, is this tied in with an overall blindness to what our real strategic assets are? And we've always looked upon national security purely in military terms. And I don't think the United States appreciates its soft power. It doesn't appreciate the fact that in many ways the Cold War ended because of MTV and rock and roll, not because of nuclear missiles. And it seems that we've missed the big picture here again. This is about social networking. These secular, tech-savvy young Arab revolutionaries, not just operating in Egypt, by the way, but networking throughout the entire Middle East.
Well, you know, that's true, you know, for a certain level of society, but it's more basic than that. You have a country of 80 million. It's every 10 months, it's adding another million people. You've got Cairo that's adding 1,000 people a day. That's a lot of people for a city with no infrastructure. You've got no jobs for these people. And eventually, they're going to rise up in riots. They're just not going to care. I mean, it's that basic common sense. And, you know, and we're spending tens of billions of dollars in Afghanistan going after a threat that's probably no longer a threat. You know, we've completely missed the boat on this, I think, because if the Middle East does go up in flames, you have to look at Bahrain today and Tehran and Algeria, you know, you have something that could be akin to 1989, and we've just missed it.
Well, Yemen started over the weekend, so did Algeria. Morocco is also a possible domino that could fall to the democratic contagion. And Bahrain, as you mentioned today, and on Friday, of course, in Iran, they have the anniversary of Khomeini's takeover, and the regime is frantic in Iran, trying to stop the the Green Movement. At the same time, they spent the last few weeks trying to take credit for what's happening in Egypt, right?
Well, it's I find it quite amazing, because I'm an Arabist, and I had spent years and years predicting that the street would rise, the first Gulf War, and so on. I was absolutely wrong, and all of a sudden, you know, this sort of vague prediction has turned out to be true. And I can't tell you, and I've spent, you know, my adult life in the Middle East, where it's going next, and that should scare a lot of people, because don't look at Egypt as being done. There was a military coup last Friday, and every time there's been a military coup in Egypt, and I'm talking about 1952, and when Sadat succeeded Nasser, and when Mubarak succeeded Sadat, there's always been a turn to the Muslim Brotherhood. There's always been a extreme nationalism in Egypt when it comes under threat. And we simply can't predict what they're going to do next. They may, I'm not saying they will, repudiate Camp David at some point if there's a popular elected parliament. It probably wouldn't be wise. But when you get the people out in the street, this is what happens.
Well, just to deal with the most recent book you wrote, Robert Baer, The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower, given that there's a build-up now to the Friday celebrations, which the government's frantically trying to control, and they've arrested placed the two opposition leaders, who are Ayatollahs, under house arrest. My understanding of what is going on in Egypt with the people behind this movement, not the Muslim Brotherhood, who you just said might come back, my understanding was that they were somewhat marginalized by this revolution. It was precipitated by these tech-savvy young people, including this Google executive. And I understand they're networking across the states and across the Middle East, using the works, by the way, of an American, Gene Sharp, as their inspiration. He also was the inspiration for the Otpor uprising in Serbia and the various uprisings in the former Soviet states, Ukraine, Georgia, etc. So isn't there a fundamental difference between what the young Arab street feels and this reactionary Islamo-fascist regime that's holding on to power in Tehran?
Well, I think, you know, we have to look at, first of all, as Twitter is, I mean, how many Egyptians really have smartphones that are on their phones that are communicating like this? You know, there's probably about 70 million of them that aren't. And they haven't really, you know, weighed in on this revolution yet. What you find in Egypt is there's a whole big part of the population which falls back on conservative Islam, whether you call it the Muslim Brotherhood or one of the other 400 Islamic organizations there. It's just impossible to predict. I mean, you'd be better off asking an Egyptian expert, but I don't. And it's the same way with Iran. It's a country that the young men and women could spark a revolt, but what's going to happen to the countryside? Who's going to follow? What's going to happen to the labor unions? What's going to happen to the military, and especially the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps? That could split up next week, for all we know. And this is what I'm talking about, though, is the blindness of Americans. Is we're so remote from this, you know, this ground up politics which seems to be taking over, that I wouldn't dare predict what's going to happen.
Well, you've made the point, I think, which is well taken, Robert Baer, that all of our assets, our military and intelligence assets, are drawn to these two losing wars, Iraq, which we've effectively lost, and Iran won, and Afghanistan, that we're mired in, spending $100 to $150 billion a year on a country with a GDP of $15 billion. That one is going nowhere. So it seems to me, though, that the thing that I'm trying to pin down here, which I'm responding to what you just said, is that are we therefore being somewhat misled by the euphoria of this sort of young middle class revolt in Egypt, and to some extent the Green Movement in Iran, in as much as while they share our values and want our way of life, they may be able to spark a revolution but not contain and control the aftermath of the revolution? Is that what you're saying?
Oh, I think absolutely. I think we have to look at Egypt. It was a classical military coup against Mubarak. I mean, even Omar Suleiman, the man who took over, said it was a coup d'etat. And I think we have to look at that now. The question is, what is the military going to do? Is it going to establish a democratic parliament, elections, a new constitution, and the rest of it? Or is it going to repress Egyptians? And we're just going to have to wait to see on that, because I'm not even sure they know themselves right now. They prefer to kick this can down the road, and that's the same way it goes for Tehran. Will the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps come out in the street with armor and suppress another revolution there? That's to be seen.
Well, the point that you made earlier about Egypt, essentially having, I believe the CIA did have reports on what's called the youth bulge, and that's a phenomenon throughout the entire Middle East, that it's largely demographically young and getting younger part of the world, where these old autocrats, potentates, and dictators simply aren't meeting the needs and aspirations of millions and millions of young people coming up. But with a population of 85 million, I think you're also suggesting here that that country, which already has a natural resource problem, right? There's not enough water. It's got to be, did you say 1,000 people a day are added to the population of Cairo?
Of Cairo, yeah. And with no new infrastructure, basically.
Right. So there's
yeah.
That's a time bomb ticking. Yeah.
And the other time bomb that's hard to factor in is, for instance, China's wheat crop, which is going to be more or less fail this year, whether it's down 20 or 30%, I don't know, as well as Australia's just drought in various parts of the world. And if commodity prices shoot up along with oil, you know, Brent is up to $104 or something like that today. If this all continues to go up, it's going to squeeze the average Egyptian, and they will be out in the street for different reasons.
Mm-hmm. So here we have a situation, again, I'm speaking with Robert Baer, former top CIA Middle East operative, author of The Devil We Know, dealing with the new Iranian superpower. So we have our focus is on the two wars that we've spent an enormous amount of treasure on, and we've lost one and we're in the process of losing another. Our military and intelligence assets are all being drained to service that kind of quagmire. Then you have these extraordinary demographic effects, and then you have the possibility of commodity prices running up and causing, you know, food riots, et cetera. Do you think the president's being given the benefit of a kind of conversation like the one that we're having?
I think they deal one crisis at a time. I think that during this one, from the beginning of February, the president was demanding to know what's going through Mubarak's mind. What's he going to do? You know, we saw us sending a special envoy to Cairo. We didn't really get an answer.
And then he completely embarrassed the president by going to Munich and saying that he thought Mubarak should stay.
Well, his law firm works for Mubarak. I mean, what was that? Was a little bit
Well, apparently there's a bit of a battle going on between Hillary and Gates and the old guard and the kind of young people in the, on Obama's National Security Council, like Samantha Power, who are more into the 21st century.
There should be a battle, but let's give the president the benefit of the doubt. He inherited this system, and it's broken, and Washington is broken. I mean, come on, you know, what we should have on the ground in Cairo today is people that have spent 15 to 20 years there working in the Foreign Service or the CIA who have a fat Rolodex and a lot of sources to, you know, to get ahead of this wave. And we don't have that because the Foreign Service has picked up this Harvard Business School of Management that you could move a manager from one job to another. So one day you're in Kabul, the next day you're in Caracas. It doesn't work. That's the problem of American society, not just the Foreign Service.
Well, apparently the lack of specialty is so pervasive that you can't even. I mean, you're better off reading the New York Times, but by the time you're reading the New York Times, it's too late, right?
That's it's over. And they suffer the same problems. They're moving correspondents from around the world to Cairo, and they have to catch up. I just talked to a guy who was over at my house that just came back from eastern Afghanistan, and he was appalled to find out that our troops still do not have translators from English into Pashto. They rely on Dari speakers.
Right.
So, you know, we have no clue what's going on in Kandahar and places like that. We can't speak the language. We don't have translators. We are bogged down in a quagmire. And in the meantime, the old nation states of the Middle East are wobbly.
Just to return to the last book that you wrote, Robert Baer, The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower, do you think that, you said you don't know what's going to happen next week. I was surprised. I spoke yesterday with Deborah Amos, who's NPR's Middle East correspondent. She's in Saudi Arabia. And I wasn't referring to your earlier book, The Devil We Know, but I was talking about whether or not this social networking and stuff is going on in Saudi Arabia. And I said, you know, as much as we're afraid of the Muslim Brotherhood and perhaps overstated in Egypt, you can't understate the influence of the Mutawa king. And she said that it's really changing, that the current king has liberalized, that she's walking around Saudi Arabia now without a veil, and kids are, boys and girls or young people are actually together in public, and the religious police aren't stopping them. So are there things to be hopeful about? I don't think we can be hopeful about Iran, but in other parts of the Arab world?
Well, I think it's hopeful. I mean, we should break down these systems in the Gulf. They haven't worked well. They fueled Islamic fundamentalism in Egypt, in Afghanistan. We're not served well by them. The misuse of their money, we're not served well by. And, you know, these systems are built on lies. You saw the WikiLeaks came out, and it's a very good report if you read it. The Saudis have lied about their oil reserves, and they're 40% less than they say they are. That's a potential catastrophe. And we need to shine a little bit of light on these systems. And, you know, you just keep your fingers crossed on Egypt and Saudi Arabia. Let the Al Saud fall. They're not our friends.
Well, given what they've done to how much they've radicalized Pakistan and Afghanistan, I couldn't help agreeing with you. Many people have described them as the Taliban with oil. I think it's a fair description.
They started the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. They, you know, with Zia-ul-Haq, they started in Pakistan, the fundamentalism, as well as Afghanistan, simply because they wanted to defend their system, their ownership of Saudi Arabia, and fight communism and Nasserism. And this is what we're getting is blowback. Now, if we could turn a secular elite that could spark a revolution like they did in France in 1789, hey, we got something going.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us today, Robert Baer.
Thank you.
Good to talk to you again. Again, I was speaking then with Robert Baer, who is the author of the New York Times bestseller Sleeping with the Devil, about the Saudi royal family and its relationship with the United States, and See No Evil, which recounts Baer's years as a top CIA Middle East operative. See No Evil was the basis of the acclaimed film Syriana, which earned George Clooney an Oscar for his portrayal of Mr. Baer. His most recent book is The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower. Let's take a brief station break, and we'll return in a moment and talk with economist James Galbraith about Obama's new budget proposal. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and I'm speaking with James Galbraith, an economics professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Policy at the University of Texas at Austin. He's also a senior scholar at the Levy Economics Institute and is chairman of the board of the Economists for Peace and Security. His books include Balancing Acts, Technology, Finance, and the American Future, Created Unequal, The Crisis in American Pay, Inequality and Industrial Change, A Global View, and The Predator State. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Galbraith.
Good evening.
And in terms of the of where we stand with these two budgets, first of all, we don't have a budget for 2011, and they're talking about the 2012 budget and operating on what are they? It's called a continuing resolution. And don't we hit the rubber hits the road right on March the 4th.
Well, that's right. There will have to be action taken at that time. You're referring to the debt ceiling?
Yes, the debt ceiling Yes. So in terms of the overall discussion, we've got two budgets here to talk about. The Republican House's budget proposals, as much as we know about them, and the presidents that have been released today. It seems to me, James Galbraith, that just in terms of the emperor's clothes, there are three big lies, to my mind, that are muddying the waters. And just let me know whether you think I'm on the right track here. One, that we should even be talking about cutting the deficit and not stimulating the economy. Two, we're only arguing about 12% of the overall budget. And three, that revenues, which are the only ways to redress the deficit, are not on the table.
True, for the most part. I think there are, in fact, some revenue increases in the Obama budget. It's about, I think, one-third of the projected savings, at least according to the news reports that I've seen. But broadly, yes, I'm actually encouraged by the extent to which this is become political theater. I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I think the Republicans have done what they did in 1981 and 1985. They've yielded to what you might call their inner Edna St. Vincent Millay. You know, my candle burns at both ends, it shall not last the night. When the Republicans come to power abruptly, there's always a faction inside the Republican Party that says, we've got to do everything right away. Damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead. We've got to enact our agenda because our moment of dominance may not last. And in 1981, that led to the so-called Reagan Revolution, which got them a backlash in the 82 elections. And in 95, it led to the Gingrich Revolution, which got them a backlash in 96. Clinton was reelected in 98 when the Democrats came back. So this is a historic tendency, which I think we're seeing repeated. Extraordinarily draconian cuts, severe cuts in any program that supports anybody who isn't actually a Republican. And as a result, it gives the White House a political opening, which they are taking advantage of. And they're doing it by focusing on the same part of the budget, by offering some large cuts, which are quite painful to their own constituency, the cuts in low-income heating assistance being the major thing that's been in the press anyway. And then a lot of small cuts, some of which are justifiable, some of which are arguable, some of which are probably bad. Yet that gives the president and the White House the image of being both serious and reasonable. And that's going to be strong political ground for them.
But I don't feel that there's any great leadership going on here.
Well, I didn't say there was. They say a political game, which is being fought out on the territory of the right wing.
Right.
I'm happy that for the moment, neither side is talking about cutting Social Security and Medicare, but I think it's almost certain that they will return to that later on. But this is an issue which, as you said, affects a small fraction of the total budget, and that at least means that the total damage will be somewhat limited. It will, however, as cuts get made, a lot of good things, useful things, will go by the boards. I don't know whether the program to clean up the Great Lakes is or is not cost-effective, but that the decision to cut that program, certainly not made on any cost-benefit grounds, is just being made because the administration was looking for something that they could sacrifice and get a headline for declaring that they were cutting.
But in terms of leadership, now it's obvious that the Congress, the House, controls the purse strings, and they've always issued a budget, and it's only since the 1920s that the president has issued a budget. But the long and the short of it is, with the president's bully pulpit, I would think that at this point it'd be great to hear somebody say, well, it's true we're only dealing with 12% of the overall budget, and that the big entitlement funds, we're under pressure to do something about Social Security, but it really does generate revenues and always has, and it's been running a surplus up until recently, and frankly, we can fix that fairly easily to make it sustainable. But the real driver of our deficit and our economic problems is out-of-control healthcare costs, and I don't know whether
I don't think this is quite correct. I mean, there are some forecasts of out-of-control healthcare costs, which cause certain people trouble. But the drivers of the deficit are, first of all, the financial crisis, the collapse of Wall Street, and the subsequent collapse of the economy, collapse of tax revenues, and then, to a lesser extent, the tax policies that we've been pursuing for quite a long time, but particularly since 2001. And the wars, those things are deficit drivers. The healthcare costs are largely paid in the private sector. That's where the big problem with healthcare costs is. So Medicare actually reimburses at a lower rate than private health insurance does. Mm-hmm. And Social Security, which people talk about all the time, as you say, has an offsetting revenue stream, which has for decades been much larger than the benefit payout. So Social Security, on net, has reduced the deficit.
So I've, to some extent, even got it wrong here by listening to this non-debate. So the real argument then for a leader to make would be, look, we're in this hole because of what happened on Wall Street recently, the trillions we spent on these wars, one of which we lost in Iraq and the Iranians won, and two that we're mired in Afghanistan. And our previous guest, a former CIA officer, said one of the reasons that the CIA missed what was happening in Egypt is that all of our resources and all of our Arab speakers are in Iraq and Afghanistan. So it seems to me that there are some very, very good political, historical arguments to be made here for how we got into the mess, let alone how we get out of it.
Yeah, I too would like to see a clear and truthful account of what is happening. I think it would also be good to have an honest rendering of the economics, but I'm not naive. The number of people who could render the economics in an honest way is very small, and it doesn't include anybody that I know of on the White House staff. I mean, I think some of them are quite good, actually, but you're not going to get a fully coherent and accurate story from any part of the political spectrum. The pressures to conform to the standard norms of discourse, to play up the deficit and the national debt as though they were really big problems, are just too great.
Well, but this deficit hoax has clearly pervaded and permeated the debate. It's the press have fallen for it. No, you know.
That's my point. It's that if you're a political person, your capacity to tell the truth in public is really quite restricted, and that's even if you're the president. That's fact. You have to be a president with an extraordinary capacity to project authority, and we haven't had one of those in. Well, I was supposed the last one was Reagan, and Reagan could project authority and could make people believe the most fantastic things, which he did, and that's part of the problem we have now.
Well, let me remind the audience again, I'm speaking with economist James Galbraith. We're talking about the president's budget, and also I'd like to talk a little bit about the Republican House's budget, which, as you know, James Galbraith, the Tea Party young freshmen weighed in a little bit. They were unhappy about the amounts being cut and wanted to get at least $100 billion out of it. Do you think they're going to get their way? Because the one thing that I find about what I could read about what they're really doing. And I think in many ways, the black ink of their budget really does state their priorities. As you know, recently the head of the EPA has been getting a tongue lashing. They seem obsessed with getting rid of the EPA, but at the same time they want to maintain a huge tax breaks for oil companies. They want to get rid of alternative energy. There seems to be a political agenda here.
You think?
Well, I think it's
a political agenda. I'm shocked to hear you.
Well,
say
I'm thinking.
That.
Let
Captain Renault in Rick's Casino. There are two agendas on the Republican side. One of them is, as you say, to satisfy their lobbies and their constituencies, and that is the same old business reactionary business program that they have been associated with. That was the policy of the Bush administration, to turn over every regulatory agency to the worst aspect, the worst players in the regulated communities, to turn over coal mine safety to the worst mine operators, destroy the EPA, as you've described, hamstring the Food and Drug Administration. One could go on and on. And the other piece of it is to cut programs that benefit people who are not Republicans, as I said earlier, cut low-income support programs, cut programs that support infrastructure, cut programs that support public education. This is an agenda which they feel they have an opportunity to advance, and they're advancing it very aggressively. It is interesting that principles get bent when important things are at stake, and as my friend, the great budget analyst Scott Lilly, has pointed out in a piece that the Center for American Progress published yesterday, Speaker Boehner has carefully protected a $450 million program to provide the Pentagon with a second jet engine for the Joint Strike Fighter that the Pentagon doesn't even want, has no use for, but does happen to be produced largely in Mr. Boehner's home district in the city of Dayton, as well as in Columbus, Ohio, which he's also quite close to. So this is shall we say, there's an element of pragmatism in their approach. It's not entirely driven by a pure anti-spending ideology.
Well, just so that you don't think I'm totally naive, I was about to say that I can see the fingerprints of the Koch brothers in these budget priorities. They're the Koch industries are among the country's largest polluters, and they put a lot of money into these Tea Party guys who supposedly stand for the people, not for the powerful, and yet their priorities are to take care of the oligarchs. So that's my little speech there, for what it's worth.
Well, it would hardly come as a surprise. Yeah, I think there's a lot to that.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, and I hope to stay in touch with you as this wrangling continues.
My pleasure, as always.
Thank you. Again, I was speaking with James Galbraith, and Professor of Economics at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Policy at the University of Texas in Austin. He's also a senior scholar of the Levy Economics Institute and is chair of the board of Economists for Peace and Security. His books include Balancing Acts, Technology, Finance, and the American Future, Created Unequal, The Crisis in American Pay, Inequality and Industrial Change, A Global View, and Predator State. We'll take a short break and return talking with Adele Stand about the recent CPAC meeting. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and I'm speaking with Adele Stan, who is Alternet's Washington Bureau Chief and co-editor of Dangerous Brew, Exposing the Tea Party's Agenda to Take Over America. The book is available only from Alternet at alternet.org/dangerousbrew. She covered the CPAC meeting last week and has an article on alternet.org called Right-Wing Disunity Clashes at this Year's Conservative Political Action Conference. And I suppose the height of the most surreal part of the event, which I've obviously learned from your article, Adele, is the notion that Dick Cheney presented Donald Rumsfeld with the Defender of Liberty Award, and in doing so, they were booed and heckled. They got a little bit of their own shock and awe these are the Ron Paul Tea Partiers. Which faction was it?
It did appear to be mostly Ron Paul enthusiasts who tend to trend young. You know, he's got a good following on a strong following on certain college campuses. But I got to say, Ian, the name of the award was even worse than that. It was the Defender of the Constitution Award. And, you know, we don't find torture in our Constitution. We don't, you know. It was just an extraordinary moment to see these grand old men of the grand old party.
Well, I know Rumsfeld is impervious to anything. He's probably one of the most ego-driven guys. I don't know whether you saw his interview, the Diane Sawyer interview, where he trashed Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell. It doesn't seem like much gets to him, except when he talks about his own children who are drug addicts and who are screwed up. I wonder why. Did any of this get to him?
Yeah, it did. He made some kind of remark like, oh, stick it or something like that at one point. But what was really interesting was that the heckling was not just like random heckling. I mean, people had very precise messages that they wanted to convey. And, you know, one was about the war. People were shouting, "Where's Bin Laden?" And it was a very telling moment, because the deal is that, you know, Ron Paul is a libertarian, kind of, sort of. I mean, he calls himself a libertarian, and quite isolationist and anti-war. And you have this conference taking place in Washington, D.C., which has many, many colleges and universities. And CPAC, to its credit, in terms of its movement-building strategy, makes a very concerted effort to court young people. You know, the right has a very long view, Ian. They are always building for the next generation. And I think that on the left, we tend to have a shorter-term view of things.
Again, I'm speaking with Adele Stan, who's Alternet's Washington Bureau Chief, and she has an article at alternet.org called "Right-Wing Disunity Clashes at This Year's Conservative Political Action Committee." So the fact that CPAC have let in Ron Paul and these younger people, that might explain why Ron Paul won the straw poll of presidential hopefuls with 30% of the vote, with Mitt Romney with 23%. I guess we can't forget Michelle Bachmann with what, 4%, was it?
4%, and Sarah Palin only came in with 3%.
What about Sarah Palin? What did she get?
3%.
3%.
Yeah.
I see. Oh, well.
But, you know, straw polls, of course, are unscientific, and they have to do, basically, they're a display of a candidate's ability to organize, which is, you know, useful information for, you know, those of us who are parsing tea leaves, you know. Palin chose not to participate in CPAC. Huckabee chose not to participate, and that, at least on Huckabee's count, that had to do with the inclusion of an LGBT, well, actually, they call themselves a gay group, Go Proud, as a co-sponsor. But Bachmann was ubiquitous at this conference. It's almost like you could not get away from her. You know, she appeared on the, she was the keynote kickoff speaker. She gave a reception at the end of that day. The next day she was on a big panel discussion and was around all over the place that day. And she only garnered 4%.
Well, this is an interesting subtext, isn't it? The Go Proud inclusion by David Keene, the long-serving president of CPAC, who's being replaced by Al Cardenas, who I think is going to ditch Go Proud from the inclusion in the next one. But their inclusion also forced the Heritage Foundation, the Family Research Council, to boycott it, along with, as you mentioned, Mike Huckabee and Senator Jim DeMint, and, of course, Sarah Palin. I presume that was her reason as well.
Well, it's hard. Palin doesn't, you know, there's a lot of things Palin does not show up at, and she did not make a statement about Go Proud, so it's hard to say if that was the reason that she did not come. But it certainly was a convenient, you know, moment thing not to show up at because of that. But yes, you're absolutely right. I mean, what Cardenas said, talking to a right-wing blog from Forum, that, you know, they really can't afford to alienate their good friends at places like the Heritage Foundation and the Family Research Council and Concerned Women for America and a whole host of other organizations that did boycott over the Go Proud inclusion. But and there was also, you know, some real rumblings from a real grand dame of the right, and that would be Phyllis Schlafly, who served as mistress of ceremonies. She obviously did not boycott, but she served as the mistress of ceremonies at the gala dinner. But on a panel discussion earlier that same day, Cleta Mitchell, who is the chairman of the American Conservative Union Foundation, which is the sponsoring organization, the foundation for the sponsoring organization of CPAC, said she had discussed the Go Proud problem, quote-unquote problem, with Phyllis Schlafly on the phone, and said Phyllis Schlafly was a great woman of vision because she explained how marriage equality could lead to forced marriage and child marriage and polygamy and all kinds of terrible things. I think this moment really shows the possibility for splintering within the conservative coalition with the exit of David Keane.
And Adele Stan, one of the things that's extraordinary about the capture of the GOP by these people, both the Tea Parties and the right-wing activists, obviously, if you do the forensics, you find out it all traces back to the Koch brothers in most cases. But the fact that two of their big stars are people who have made films that have been have relied entirely upon distortion and manipulation. The idea that these liars and dissemblers would become heroes. The fellow behind the Citizens United, who of course made the film that became the Supreme Court decision to unleash unlimited corporate money in elections, their new film was highlighted, Fire in the Heartland. But the guy that founded that used to work for Republican Congressman Dan Burton, and he distorted the prison conversations of Webb Hubble from the recordings of his conversations when he was in jail, when he was supposed to be Clinton's Attorney General, and re-edited them to incriminate him, and eventually he was fired by Burton because he was caught. And we know that Andrew Breitbart also distorted a talk that this woman from the Agricultural Department, which destroyed her career, gave. He apparently was served. Was he served at the site, at the CPAC, by Shirley Sherrod, who is now suing him?
Right. The process service for working on behalf of Shirley Sherrod served Breitbart with papers for her lawsuit against him for damaging her reputation through his selective editing of her address to a local NAACP chapter. That he, you know, manipulated to make it appear as if she were condoning anti-white prejudice, which, of course, was exactly the opposite of her message. But Breitbart, that's a fascinating bit of business, by the way, about Dan Burton. I wasn't aware of that. And it does seem to be of all of a piece, doesn't it, Ian? Breitbart, you know, was just, his usual astonishing self at CPAC. On the one hand, you know, he hosted a gay-themed party, looking to be a provocateur to the old line social conservatives. And they gave out bumper stickers that said, our gays are more macho than their straights. On the other hand, he got up on the podium. He used his big time on the podium, on the main stage, to really carry water for the Koch brothers, who had had, as many of your listeners probably know, a big confab in Palm Springs several weeks ago, and were met there by a number of progressive protesters.
A couple of whom I interviewed, yes.
There you go. And, you know, Breitbart, I mean, that was really the whole, he used most of his speech to discuss you know, to paint this story, this picture of himself as this hero on rollerblades confronting these protesters whom he labeled animals, who he said were poised for violence. He described himself as standing in alone in what he called a DMZ between a vanguard of riot police and protesters who were ready to storm the riot police. And then he just unleashed this sexist, really sexist, misogynist barrage on the women of Code Pink, you know, whom he called long in the tooth. And he said, you know, they used to be something to look at because they used to be slutty. And, I mean, it was just...
Slutty lefties, right?
Yeah, it was unbelievable. And, you know, you don't even read about it in the mainstream media that here this... This big, you know, official, decades-old conservative institution puts this guy on the podium, and this is what he says, and you don't even hear about it. It just flummoxes me, and I did.
Well, would he actually be interested in slutty lefties? Because I mean, so many of these guys are in the closeted gay Republican movement, aren't they? You know.
Well, it's not for me to decide.
but I mean, the other what's that? Grover Norquist, the whole crowd of them are all family values by day and militarystuds.com by night.
Well, you know, it's that whole Victorian, you know, conundrum, right? Where but it was quite a thing. And I did ask the organizers of CPAC for comment on Breitbart's speech if they had any concerns about his dehumanizing language, and I never got a response back.
Well, he proudly proclaimed that he picketed Jody Evans's house. She's the co-founder when she was hosting a fundraiser for California Governor Jerry Brown, who incidentally got elected. Tell me about Adele Stan, again, Alternet's Washington Bureau Chief. She has a piece at alternet.org called Right-Wing Disunity Clashes at This Year's Conservative Political Action Conference. She covered the CPAC meeting last week. And into the weekend it went, right?
Yes, it did. It ended on Saturday evening.
And tell me about this retired lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Army, Alan West, who was gave the final evening address. He's their answer to Barack Obama, in as much as he's an African American. But he was relieved of his command for his abuse of detainees in Iraq. So when you talk about Cheney giving Rumsfeld an award for preserving the Constitution and being responsible for introducing torture associating torture with the United States, which of course has cost us dearly around the world since every dictator, including Mubarak, says, well, we can torture our own people, you Americans do it. The cost of that
and
is...
And in fact, let us torture prisoners for you.
Right. Let's outsource it. So tell me about this guy who, I guess, to that crowd, the fact that he was booted out of the army for torturing detainees, that's a badge of honor, right?
Yeah, it is. It's a big plus. And, you know, West actually even, you know, sort of condemned Barack Obama for, quote-unquote, imprisoning our warriors for killing terrorists, end quote. And he didn't say what he was referring to. But West is really precisely that sort of authoritarian figure who plays so well to the right. And that's the thing to understand about the right. It is an authoritarian movement more than any other ideology. I mean, the libertarians can argue with the social conservatives and but the unifying principle is authoritarianism and deregulation. So with a guy like West, he's sort of the perfect storm of all of those things. Plus, he confers the added insulation from the charge of racism, which at least that's, you know, what the movement people feel when they applaud him. that how can, you know, how can we be racist if, you know, this is our guy? And in fact, he opened his speech basically by saying that, you know, he says to them, you know, a victimization is also a big part of the theme. I mean, the basic old right-wing themes that Alan West really embodies is that sense of victimization by really the dominant class. Which is
and of course the liberal media, that canard, that old chestnut.
Right, right. Well, the liberal media are part of the ways in which the regular white, real, definitive American culture, as West said, he didn't call it white, but you know, there is a definitive American culture, and he railed against multiculturalism, that the regular white people are, you know, oppressed by these things, such as the liberal media, which he did rant about.
Well, he spoke with pride of having been named worst person five times by former MSNBC host Keith Olbermann, which actually brings into question whether Olbermann was actually doing anything useful.
Well, yeah, well, we could argue that on a whole other show, but the thing is that what was very interesting is he never mentioned Olbermann by name. He talked about being named worst person, and then he says, and he got fired for it, which of course is not at all true. But you know, what's a little lie between patriots?
Well, Adele, it's lovely talking with you, and I congratulate you on the work that you've done, hanging out with the American right, and of course none of their money will trickle down to you. That's the curse of being on the left, right? We're all impoverished. If only we could sell out to the Koch boys, we'd be rich.
Oh yeah, we need to find a few more big billionaires, and we'll be fine.
I know. They try to suggest that George Soros is the reason why the Kochs are virtuous, but there's no symmetry there.
No.
I wish there was. I wish he was supporting me. All right. Thanks for joining us here today.
Thank you so much for having me, Ian.
Bye bye. And hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Adele Stan, who is Alternet's Washington Bureau Chief and co-editor of Dangerous Brew, Exposing the Tea Party's Agenda to Take Over America, a book that's only available at alternet.org/dangerousbrew. She covered the CPAC meeting last week and has an article on alternet.org called Right-Wing Disunity Clashes at This Year's Conservative Political Action Conference. This has been Background Briefing. You can hear this program and others at ianmasters.com, where you can also sign up for podcasts and contact me. Our producers are Spencer Downing and Samantha Sumampong. Our engineer is Devin Jordan. I'll be back tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.